Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. I'm Boris Hassan. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, we'll travel to Maquasis in central Alberta to learn about the new water pipelines coming out of the Red Deer water line.
It's easy to get hung up on the problems that most First Nations are experiencing, but what we hope to do and our goal is to accomplish is how do we start finding solutions, bringing the right people to the table, having the right conversations, asking the right questions, finding solutions that are going to work both for today and for the future.
Quebec's Forest Firefighting Agency warns of the danger of brush fires because spring is a period with the most forest fires in Quebec.
It takes just a few hours of sun and wind, and then the dry grass, the dried leaves, the understory becomes very dry and is quickly flammable.
Generosity is contagious in British Columbia. The First Light Farm decided to grow food and give it away.
Our goal is 10,000, but that's a lofty goal, and that's a lot of food to bring. So that would take some extra work, but we're planning on it, and we'll see how much we can raise.
In Quebec, the marché des artisanat rekindles the arts and crafts market and spirit in Dunham. And the life and times of a death doula, Jackie has been caring for the dying for the past 10 years.
Everybody deserves to have a good death. And that is very, very important to me. And that's why I don't care about where or how or, like I said, I'm not there to judge. And I don't care what religion. I personally have no religious beliefs.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Nice to have you with us. We start things off in central Alberta, where a conference was recently held in Maquasis. The goal of the conference was to educate residents about how water makes its way into the surrounding Four Nations and about the treatment process behind it all. Mario Swampy, Sampson Cree Nation Councillor and NIPI Chairman, spoke at the conference about the future of the water treatment in Maquasis. They say that having conversations about upgraded water lines is not as simple as they would like it to be. It's quite a complex issue, Swampy said. This, as new water pipelines are planned to come to Maquasis and the surrounding Four Nations from the Red Deer water line. Ryan Hunt in Edmonton, Alberta, spoke with the Sampson Cree Nation Councillor Mario Swampy.
What we're doing here today is we wanted to just provide our nation members with some information on all things related to water. When we talk about water for First Nations, it's quite a complex issue, and you can't capture it whether you're talking about it from a political level. Like, you got to talk about it from a spiritual, historical, treaty, legal. It's such a big, robust topic that in order to do it justice, you got to bring the right people to the table to have a robust conversation about it and hopefully inform and educate people, because it's easy to get hung up on the problems that most First Nations are experiencing. But what we hope to do and our goal is to accomplish is how do we start finding solutions, bringing the right people to the table, having the right conversations, asking the right questions, finding solutions that are going to work both for today and for the future.
Swampy goes on to talk about the future of water in Maskwacis.
Here in Maskwacis, we have the Four Nations. We, obviously, being Sampson Cree Nation, when it comes to that, there's jurisdictional challenges because we're dealing with both the federal government and the provincial government. And then you've got the four separate governments in Maskwacis. So sometimes having a conversation is not as simple as we'd like it to be. But as it comes to the water pipes that are happening, there are water pipes coming to Maskwacis from the Red Deer water line. Here in Sampson, though, currently what we're working on is wastewater. Wastewater has kind of been the focus. So a lot of that conversation around water lines is still kind of in the works.
NIPI means something very special, and Swampy explains what it means and its significance.
NIPI is a derivative of two words, Niapimat, this one, which means I am life. Water is life. And we don't want to just say it as a catchphrase. We want it to be reflected in how we are stewards of water, how we respect water, how we access water, how we keep it clean and safe. But in saying that, we also have to recognize and appreciate what we've inherited from generations of inadequate funding models that have kind of plagued us to the point where we've got aging infrastructure, where we're trying to find solutions that are addressing those historical challenges for solutions today, but again, going to the future. So what are we able to leave for our future generations?
I'm Ryan Hunt.
Tune to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
And there's never enough water for Quebec's Forest Firefighting Agency, Société de Protection des Forêts contre le Feu, known as SOPFEU. It's warning residents of southern Quebec about the danger of brush fires this time of year. SOPFEU explains that spring is the period with the most forest fires in Quebec. We know that sounds strange since spring is usually known for rainy and wet conditions. While the size of the fires in the summer months might be larger, the frequency of fires this time of year is the highest. So far this year, there have been two forest fires in the Outaouais region. Journalist Caleb Nickerson is located in the Pontiac region, and he's back with us at canada-info.ca. He spoke with Mélanie Morin, Communication and Prevention Specialist with the Provincial Forest Firefighting Service, SOPFEU, to discuss the dangers of spring fires.
Mélanie, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, not so bad. Could you talk with me a little bit about your spring prevention campaign? What are you guys focusing on here?
The SOPFEU sent out its first communications in the last week or so, advising people that spring fires are upon us. We did have a rash of them at the beginning of April. The biggest challenge with spring is to have people understand that it, even though, you know, it rained a day or two ago, or that, you know, that area had snow a day or two ago, and perhaps deeper in the ground things are still wet, but on the surface it takes just a few hours of sun and wind, and then the dry grass, the dried leaves, the dried branches, the understory becomes very dry and is quickly flammable.
Is spring the most common time to see these types of fires here?
It is.
How does it compare to summer?
Spring is our busiest time, is the time that has the most forest fires in Quebec. I know that also can be a bit of a shock to people. People think, you know, summer and high temperatures, that sort of thing. But no, it really is this time of year that is the most conducive to having forest fires.
So I guess it's greater numbers, maybe not quite as big as some of the ones during the summer there, or?
Exactly. So springtime, we have lots of little fires, less big ones, but again, little is relative, right? If you have the fire in your backyard and it is threatening, the plantation next to your home or to your shed or to your deck or that sort of thing, then it does become very real, right? So we want people to be safe, to avoid doing backyard waste burning and these activities that could get out of hand and end up burning nearby structures or forests.
So would you say that that's the biggest cause, the primary cause is people doing some spring cleaning, maybe burning some brush in their backyard, and that's what sets off these fires here?
Number one cause in spring and beginning of summer is definitely people wanting to clean their yards, brush and waste burning. But we're, you know, trying to remind people that there are other alternatives than to just burn. Many municipalities now have compost programs. There's also different eco-centers where they'll pick up green matter or they'll pick up large objects. So we encourage people to use those alternatives.
I guess it's not quite camping or ATVing season quite yet here, but in regards to those activities, what do you see as far as risky behaviors or things that might set off fires doing those types of activities as well?
So the usual human-caused activities that, you know, cause forest fires in the summer are cigarettes that have not been extinguished, campfires that were not extinguished, ATVs that do not stay on trails but do off-roading and then do end up with a buildup under the ATVs and set fires. So all those activities, as every year, we ask people to practice their outdoor activities in a safe manner and to always verify the fire danger index, which we have on our website, which we have on our app. There are lots of ways. Kind of like when we check the weather before going out in the morning, we also check to find out, is it going to be a dangerous day for forest fires? Or not.
And do you have a number on how many we've seen thus far in the Outaouais region? Or?
So far in Quebec, 15 forest fires, two in the Outaouais region, which were both in the Vallée de la Gatineau, none that have been in the Pontiac area so far.
Mélanie, I want to thank you for your time. Thanks for speaking with us about this. I'm sure we'll be speaking with you later on in the summer as forest fire season gets into full swing there. But is there anything else that you'd like to let our listeners know, or maybe that we didn't touch on yet here in this interview?
Just remind everyone that they can stay informed on the situation. We have an app that can be downloaded for all types of phones. You can choose to have notifications on it or not. You can also check out our website. It has an interactive map. We can also sign up to get daily emails. There are lots of ways to stay informed of the situation.
Hello, I'm Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, and you're listening to Viewpoints. We'll be right back.
Next, we take a quick peek at what's been going on in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, where the annual Liverpool Regional High School Scholarship Fundraiser is marking 25 years of providing money for graduates to attend post-secondary school. What started as a dinner and auction moved online during the pandemic and has been breaking donations records ever since. Last year, organizers raised over $33,000, smashing through their $22,000 goal. This year, they're challenging themselves and the community to come up with $35,000. Fundraising committee member Pierre Lozier says organizers considered returning to an in-person format, but decided to stay online because it offered benefits that could not be ignored. He spoke with journalist Ed Alverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
What we found is with the online auction format, it provides more than just a one-day event, and it provides more opportunities for folks to participate in the auction. We start in the 1st of May and go through the month into June until we've gone through the different lots of auctions. So it's a different format, but it increases our participation, and as a result also increases the funding.
The committee is composed of parents, teachers, and most importantly, students.
They are broken down into smaller groups with a mentor committee parent, and they will go and canvass the community for donations of either items to be sold at auction or some financial donations to the committee.
The auction is held on the LRHS 2023 Scholarship Fundraiser Facebook page. Items up for auction are displayed as posts, and bids can be made in the comments. Lozier says given the generosity of the community, they could surpass the set goal of $35,000.
Our community year after year just shows amazing support for this program, and we're confident that we'll continue on.
Each year, about a third of the graduating class receive $1,000 awards from the scholarship fund to support their post-secondary schooling. In the 25 years the auction has been running, over 400 students have received around $500,000 towards their continuing education from the LRHS Foundation. I'm Ed Halverson.
Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
While generosity is contagious in British Columbia, the First Light Farm decided a few years ago that it would grow food to give away. This year, it aims to grow $10,000 worth of veggies for the Revelstoke Food Bank in British Columbia, and it will do so throughout the summer. The farm started the fundraiser in 2020, the year the first pandemic lockdown forced Jesse Johnson Hill, one of the farm owners, to finally commit to farming after years of wanting to do so. But the situation is getting worse. Johnson Hill knows that the need for donations at the food bank has continued to increase every year since then. $10,000 of food is a lot of food to bring, says Jesse Johnson Hill, but they're planning on it, and they'll see how much they can raise. They'll also have to raise money for themselves as the cost of growing veggies are reaching a new plateau. Jessie's also thinking of raising prices for the other produce she's selling to make a living. It's a delicate balance. More on this with Megan Dooling in Revelstoke, British Columbia.
The snow is melting fast now, but the owner of First Light Farms says the growing season is about 2 weeks behind. They expect it to start this week, but their fields are still covered in snow. And Jesse Johnson Hill is itching to dig in the soil.
I'm trying not to measure the snow every day right now because we're way behind.
Johnson Hill has wanted to farm for years, but it was the first COVID lockdown in the spring of 2020 that finally made her commit to a plot of land in the Big Eddy. That first year, she started an online crowdsource campaign. The money raised pays for food that she and her partner grow and give to the food bank. They've done it every year since. This year's campaign opened at the beginning of April.
Our goal is 10,000, but that's a lofty goal, and that's a lot of food to bring. So that would take some extra work, but we're planning on it, and we'll see how much we can raise.
The first year they raised $3,000 or $4,000. In 2021, they raised $8,000, and last year was less at $4,000. So far, this year's campaign has just over $3,000. It's better for them to know early how much money they're going to raise so they can plan how much food to grow. Johnson Hill says it was nice the year they raised $8,000 because they were able to bring in loads of fresh vegetables to the food bank a few times a week.
We try not to just bring like delicate greens, although that's a real treat there because most greens that come from the grocery store are quite old by the time they make it there. But we try to bring heavy stuff too. We have lots of potatoes and carrots. Maybe we'd bring 20 bunches of carrots and 20 bunches of beets and 40 pounds of potatoes or 40 bags of greens, you know, like some enough that the lineup of people outside can hopefully each grab something from the farm, if not something of each that we bring. We try to bring a good assortment, like lots of tomatoes and peppers when they're in season, and yeah, good variety.
The food bank is run by Community Connections. Because of COVID, use tripled in 2020, the year Johnson Hill started farming. That fall, the food bank and outreach programs expanded into the location on 2nd Street West. Melissa Hemphill manages the food programs at Community Connections. They include the community kitchen, the food recovery program, and the food bank. Getting fresh produce deliveries all summer from the Big Eddy is really quite spectacular, Hemphill says.
It's such a win-win program. Like, not only do the donations support food coming to the food bank, but they're also supporting young entrepreneurs that are getting started in our food system, producing beautiful food for us. And so it's a great kind of full circle of it all.
Donations are always helpful, but they're particularly helpful for the food bank now because, like many, it's struggling to make ends meet with the high cost of food.
Not only are those food prices affecting every household, but they're affecting the food bank as well. We have to pay more for food, too, with a higher demand of clients and a decrease in donations because there's less left over to donate. But we also know that there's a lot of wealth in the community. And so we just hope that those who have some extra to give are generous in supporting the food bank.
The number of people using the food bank each month continues to go up.
We're hovering around 800, almost up to 1,000 visits in March. More and more families and households are struggling to meet their food needs and are relying on the food bank. So it continues to be a bad news story, unfortunately.
In March, members from 285 households came through the food bank doors at least once.
Pre-pandemic, we saw around 300 households per year. And in 2022, we saw over 700. So it's a really dramatic increase.
Hannah Whitney manages the food bank. She's seeing different demographics access food than before.
We're getting more people from all types of walks of life, you know, like people who are working full-time jobs and, you know, families supporting, more families than I think there were before. And then, you know, everybody who's on assisted incomes and stuff like that. There's no like one demographic of people who are attending right now.
Johnson Hill says at their farm, they started with high prices so they wouldn't have to raise them. But the cost of growing materials is going up. So they're considering increasing the price of their produce, too.
So like feather meal or peat moss in the potting mix, like gypsum helps bring our calcium levels up. All those costs are climbing significantly.
Hemphill says they're trying to stretch their dollars as best as possible.
I think we're doing everything we can do always. It's very rarely a situation of surplus around here. And so we'll be continuing to study the problem as capacity allows, advocating for supports and funding, doing our own pieces around creative procurement and getting the best prices we can, and running the most effective events that we can for fundraising, and hoping to develop some relationships with new and existing donors to help them understand where we're at.
Johnson Hill is aware of the number of people using the food bank. Growing vegetables for them is a way to get their produce accessible to people who maybe wouldn't normally get to eat fresh, organic, local potatoes and carrots.
It's really fulfilling to drop it off and get so much appreciation for the food and make the tables look so much nicer and full of abundance. It really looks like a farmer's market in there when it's got lots of produce. And people are really psyched to get great food.
If you want to, and if you can donate, the GoFundMe campaign is up on First Light Farms' Facebook and Instagram pages. Or search First Light Farms GoFundMe to find it. In Revelstoke, I'm Megan Dooling.
Doing the right things for the right reasons and to support local artists? Well, this is the story behind the Marché des Artisanats, the artisans market in Dunham, Quebec, just outside an hour or so of Montreal in the eastern townships. Micheline Dubois started the arts and crafts market when she moved back to the area from Alberta. 5 years later, the doors of the Marché des Artisanats Dunham are still open and keep the creativity flowing. The market's fifth anniversary was celebrated last April. Here's Micheline Dubois talking to journalist Taylor McClure.
I can't believe 5 years have gone by already. We've had so many problems with COVID, and because we have a door that opens up externally, we were able to open during COVID, and we just kept on going. And here we are 5 years later, and we've had many different artisans here and many, many clients, and it's been a really, really good 5 years.
And for those who may not have been able to tune in to our interview that we had last time, can you please remind them what the Marché des Artisanats Dunham is and why you started this wonderful place?
Okay, so when I moved back here from Alberta, I joined the Women's Institute, and I noticed so many older women carrying their boxes to their tables at the Marché, at the fundraisers. And I thought, we should have an indoor place because they're standing there all day in the sun on their feet or in the rain. And we really should have a place for people to display their crafts and sell their crafts. So I opened this place, and I bought the building in November. And for the first 6 months, I just recruited the artisans. So in April 2018, we had our grand opening. And some of our artisans that were there at the time are still here, but we usually have a change when people come and go.
Everything's alternating all the time.
Yes, we have two floors, and people go upstairs and downstairs, so it's always something new and exciting. Well, I just want to say a very, very big thanks to all of our artisans and all of the people who have come through our doors over the last 5 years.
And what are your hopes moving forward?
I'm just hoping to continue because I think we're really on a roll here.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
And now to British Columbia as we turn to an unusual story produced by Pamela Hassan Otto Smithers. She has recently been producing a series about, well, death. And this week we learn about the work of a death doula. What is that, you say? The job title of death doula is one that Jackie Wagner carries out with compassion. Jackie, sitting in her Vanderhoof home office, is holding a large duffel bag, carrying an assortment of items she keeps with her at all times. Jackie defines her job as a concierge to the dying. A death doula is also sometimes called end-of-life doula, dying guide, or soul midwife. Jackie responds to the call of the dying or their loved ones. She can get a call or text at any time of day or night. So Pamela had a 20-minute chat with Jackie, the death doula. Here's a short excerpt from that very interesting conversation and subject.
Well, death doulas, they've always been around. So it's only been probably in the last 60, 70 years where we've kind of lost our skills. If you look into ancient times and you look into our history, you'll find Egypt, Tibet, India, all of those places are very much in tune with, they would call them soul midwives. And throughout history, you will see them. It's only in the last 60, 70 years and into the Middle Ages that we've lost those skills, especially here in the Western side of the country. And that's been lost because we've very much turned dying into a medical event. It went from a personal, loving part of that rite of passage for children with their parents, etc., to a hospital event where we're now seeing people dying alone and not having good deaths. Everybody deserves to have a good death. And that is very, very important to me. And that's why I don't care about where or how, or like I said, I'm not there to judge. And I don't care what religion. I personally have no religious beliefs at all. But that doesn't affect what I do, because it's not about religion. It's not about me saying one religion is wrong or one religion is right. Everybody's path is different. And every experience I have with every person is different. I recognized right away, even back then, 11 years ago, that there was a gap in our medical, our care aides, our nurses, our doctors, all of them do amazing, amazing jobs. And they really don't have the time to do what they really want. Most of them do want that time to sit and to explain to people things like the death rattle or what to expect as their loved one progresses through death. Those are things that I come in with. So I am actually an added bonus to hospice, to the death team. I'm not there to take anything away from anybody. I am there as support and to make sure that the person who is dying, if their wishes are being supported, at the end of the day, it's on their terms. People think, you know, if I talk about death, then I'm going to die. First of all, you are going to die. That's something we all can't escape. And just because we talk about dying doesn't mean we're going to die tomorrow. We all talk about winning the lottery. Does it happen right away? Nope. To understand that someone is going through that and losing every piece of themselves, right? Because they're losing control of everything. They can't hold on to anything. And that is a powerful thing to understand.
Wow, so much to learn from that conversation, that's for sure. The complete 20-minute audio interview between Pamela and Jackie the Death Doula can be found on canada-info.ca. And this concludes this edition of Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists this week, Megan Dooling, Taylor McClure, Pamela Hassan, Caleb Nickerson, Ryan Hunt, and Ed Alverson, national editors Maureen McEwen and Victoria Fenner. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Great to have you with us. Please stay tuned to the show that follows on your local radio station. Until next week, ciao.